From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. Today, Susanna Melvoin talks about her close personal and professional partnership with Prince.
He was the ultimate social worker for his music. He felt that these songs, or his children, he would say, these songs, needed to go to the right family.
Then, the composer of Child's Play makes a creepy score using toy pianos. And President Trump meets with Chinese leaders next week as Hollywood is anxious over trade tensions that could hammer box office revenue there. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Game of Thrones. Critics have hailed the final season as TV's greatest show of all time and era-defining, Emmy-eligible for Outstanding Drama Series and all other categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. When Prince died in April 2016, he left behind hundreds of hours of unreleased music. Some of those recordings can be found on the first Prince album released after his death, 2018's Piano and a Microphone. And this month comes more. The album called Originals is a collection of demos of songs that Prince wrote for other artists, like this 1984 version of Nothing Compares to You, made famous when recorded by Sinead O'Connor in 1990. The song was actually inspired by singer-songwriter Susanna Melvoin. Melvoin sang in the band called The Family, assembled by Prince as an outlet for his tireless creative drive. And it was The Family's 1985 version of Nothing Compares to You that inspired O'Connor to record the song herself.
The guitar part on that is great. Again, it's another one of his lead vocals. It's a great communicative tool for him. Our version had more space to it. That came out. It becomes an incredible R&B love ballad with Claire Fisher's string arrangements on it. But it has a lot of air and it has a lot of breath. You know, this one felt incredibly generous. Nothing Compares to You, when it was given to us, it was just heart-wrenching, you know, for many, many reasons, because I was also involved with him at the time.
Right.
So it felt communicative. And it felt personal, and it was. I wasn't the only person, apparently, that the song was about. There was a woman that worked with him by the name of Sandy Scipione, who was his personal assistant at the time, who had a death in the family, and she needed to leave. And so he was feeling this longing and loss from Sandy leaving, and also we'd had a rift, and we were going through our own thing, and it felt a way he communicated.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that 1985 version of the Prince song, Nothing Compares to You, by The Family, featuring my guest, Susanna Melvoin.
It's been so lonely without you here, like a bed without a song. Oh, 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 oh. Nothing can't stop these lonely tears from falling. Tell me, baby, where did I go wrong?
Usually my vocals were designed around what he needed me to do. And as a background vocalist, you learn how to be a part of the band. You don't stand out per se. This particular song was the first time I really used my voice on a track. You can really hear I'm singing that directly to him. That is a deeply powerful song for me.
And I think it is for everyone.
I think so, too.
And universal.
And for Sinead, who, when she heard this, I know that her manager had called, and I'd spoke with Sinead years later, and her reason, she had just been loving The Family record. She wanted to do a cover of it. And she'd had her manager call Prince and say, we want to do this cover. And here's something that's very unique for him, that he said yes to it. When someone calls and says, I want to do a cover of your song, that would never happen. He was very protective, you know, and I use that, the protection mode, again, sort of relates to his social work, to his music. Like, you can't call me and ask me for this kid. I have to vet you. And if he didn't vet you or didn't know you or didn't have a relationship with you, he wasn't going to give that up, right?
Yeah.
So, but because Nothing Compares to You had been released on
the way he wanted
the way he wanted it, but it was already out into the public sphere. It's almost like once he's given it away, he's allowed it to sort of sprout itself. So I guess it was John, I can't remember John's last name. It was Sinead's manager at the time, who called Steve Farnoli, who was Prince's manager at the time,
mm-hmm.
and said, you know, she's extraordinary. You know, she's this powerful voice and she loves this song. You know, I think it's a good idea that we, you know, let her have this.
'Cause nothing compares.
He was the ultimate social worker for his music. He felt that these needed to go. These songs, or his children, he would say, these kids, these songs, needed to go to the right family to raise this family, to raise these songs, to raise these kids. I mean, it had a deeper theme than just offering songs out. Mind you, I do believe that, you know, there's a psychology behind Prince's artistic generosity. He watched over his music carefully. He was nurturing these tracks for this particular artist to take and grow.
Well, you, of course, knew Prince intimately as a person. I think you were engaged for a time, and as an artist as well. And we know that he was fierce in proclaiming his independence from record labels mm-hmm. and from the music business in general, that he was known to be exacting in the studio and exact a lot of control over the release of his music. And as high quality and wonderful as these posthumous recordings are, originals and piano and a microphone, do you have any idea how he would feel about their release?
It would never have happened. It would never have happened. The man that I know would have never let anyone have sort of allegiance or license to do anything with his music. So to have released anything just because someone wanted to release these songs, or they need to be heard, it wouldn't have happened.
Coming up on The Frame, more with Susanna Melvoin on Prince. Then, why Hollywood studios need China to make sure their big budget blockbusters aren't a bust.
KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Sharp Objects, based on the best-selling novel by Gillian Flynn. The story focuses on Camille Preaker, a journalist with a history of psychiatric issues who returns to her rural hometown to cover the apparent murders of two preteen girls. The limited series was hailed by critics as exquisite, hauntingly compelling, and a true masterpiece. Emmy eligible for Outstanding Limited Series and all other categories. Visit hbo.com/FYC for more on Sharp Objects.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We'll pick up my conversation now with Susanna Melvoin. Throughout the 1980s, she was a backup singer and a songwriting partner of Prince. An album of his previously released recordings is out now, exclusively on Tidal, with a wider release later this week. It's called Originals. I asked Melvoin how she feels talking about this work, given how protective Prince was about his music.
Do I struggle with it? I suppose so. Although, to be pragmatic and honest, he isn't here, and that's a horrible tragedy. But when someone passes like him, and he has a treasure of music, and that I do feel as though on some level it's a responsibility to uphold his legacy,
mm-hmm.
you know, and if I feel it's being done well and in honesty and integrity, that I don't have a problem communicating my experience, and hopefully through my experience I'm upholding his legacy and his brilliance. So the family and the estate acting on his behalf is layered, I think that they're doing this particular project with a lot of integrity. Mm-hmm. Like, it feels right to be here and to talk about these things.
I wanted to ask you about another song, one that you kind of co-wrote with Prince, that you have songwriting credits are.
Yes.
That you co-wrote with Prince, and it appears on his album Sign of the Times. Mm-hmm. It's called Starfish and Coffee. The song, if I understand right, is based on a childhood friend of yours.
Yes.
What's the story?
Cynthia Rose.
Cynthia wore the prettiest dress with different color socks.
Who is still a friend of mine to this day.
Wonderful.
Yes, my classmate. And no one knew back at in those days that these special, remarkable kooks were on the spectrum. So years later, we do find out she's on the spectrum. She's she's actually a musical savant.
Wow.
And an autistic beauty. She's just an extraordinary woman. So I would tell him about Cynthia Rose and what she'd have for breakfast and her favorite number and our school rides on the bus. And we would just laugh. And now that said, those were just stories that I would throw out. But now cut to, we're living in a house that we have decided that, like, this is where we're going to start our own life together. And so there was a lot of just so much going on. So the Sign of the Times record was being recorded in the house. And one particular morning, he called Susan in Rogers, who is his sound engineer, and sat down at the kitchen table, and he'd asked me, can you do me a favor? Can you write down everything that we've talked about? Write down everything about Cynthia. So I proceeded to do that. And it's something I'd said so many times. So I'm like, okay, now check that number 20, 12, like, hey, what she'd have for breakfast, starfish and pee-pee was the original.
She would say starfish and pee-pee.
I had starfish and pee-pee for breakfast. Sure did. Yes. Uh-huh. I feel like, oh, fantastic. Yes.
Thanks for sharing.
Thanks. Yeah. Once I'd finished the story and written it out for him, he'd come over to me and he was like, okay, so, yeah, so starfish and pee-pee's just not going to work. I can't sing it. I'm sure you can't sing it. And he was like, do you mind if I put coffee in there? And I'm like, you do what you got to do. And he was like, because it's not going to happen. I'm not going to sing. I'm going to sing pee-pee. It's just not going to happen. And he went down, howling down the stairs, laughing. Susan came up 10 hours later and said, come downstairs. And he was standing at the board and pressed play. And there it was, Starfish and Coffee.
Starfish and Coffee, maple syrup and jam, butterscotch clouds, tangerine, and a side order of ham. If you set your mind free, then maybe you'd understand. Starfish and Coffee, maple syrup and jam, oh.
Coming over here, and I was listening to the Sign of Times record on my way over here, and I started to weep. It's a brilliant record. It just is. And I dreamt about him last night, which was another interesting thing. So he's been on my mind a lot. And I hope that, you know, if there is another world, that he knows that I'm upholding it with love and honesty.
Susanna Melvoin is a singer-songwriter. We've been talking about her collaborations with Prince and much more. Thank you, Susanna. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
China only allows so many Hollywood movies per year in their theaters, and for those that do break into the market, it can mean big business. But ongoing trade tensions between the U.S. and China is putting a chill on already chilly relations between Hollywood and the government officials who oversee China's film industry. Steven Zaitchik wrote about this for The Washington Post, and he says it's tough to make a big-budget film for global consumption without any guaranteed entrance into the Chinese market.
It's increasingly difficult. And, you know, China over the last few years, some listeners might be aware, has kind of grown its quota. It used to be about 20 films. Now it's 35 or more. So studios now have more options than they did before. And that means that they're going to be, again, far from assured a release there. And particularly if it's edgier content, more political, more violent, they're going to have a bit of a hard time. But there is an increasing reliance on China, which which is great as long as movies are getting in there.
Well, with these trade tensions increasing between the U.S. and China, Chinese film officials seem, at least according to your reporting, they seem in no great hurry to help studios get their films into theaters there. But isn't it in their best interest for the overall health of the Chinese film industry to get these popular movies in?
This is a great question, which is how much does China want to protect its economies? Obviously, this goes well beyond Hollywood to tech and soybeans and other realms.
Yeah.
On the one hand, and versus keeping their domestic film business humming on the other. And I think experts that I talk to seem to think the former was a lot more important. One thing that's worth keeping in mind as well is that, you know, Chinese domestic film production has gone up quite a bit. They've had some movies that have done quite well just a few months ago over the Chinese New Year, which is a big movie-going period in the country. They had a film called The Wandering Earth. Actually, Netflix bought it, and there was a small theatrical release here. This was the second biggest Chinese movie of all time, and one of the biggest of all time in the country, period. So they've had a domestic industry that's grown quite a bit over the last few years. And so while it is important to them, and it's important to government leaders to have a healthy exhibition business, a healthy movie theater business, they have their own product to rely on, and they're very conscious in this sort of process of allowing in foreign films of not having exports or rather imports, I should say, come up and exceed 50% of their box office. So they want a healthy movie business, but they don't necessarily want all or even much of it from the U.S.
Well, it's not every Hollywood studio that seems affected by these trade tensions. It appears Disney films seem to be immune from this apparent freeze out. How come?
Well, yeah, Disney has been very good at managing the Chinese relationship. You know, every studio has teams on the ground. They have people both in Los Angeles and in Beijing and elsewhere in the country to really manage the relationship. But Disney does it better than most. You know, Disney has also a business relationship with China. The Shanghai government is the majority owner of Shanghai Disney, their big theme park over there. So Disney and China are very attached to the hip. And as a result, as you point out, a lot of the movies that might otherwise be caught up in the trade war are getting released there. Endgame, again, a few months ago, Avengers Endgame came out. Toy Story is going to be coming out. They've got some other big releases, Spider-Man as well, a Disney Marvel film. So Disney seems to be exempt. And that is, you know, to go back to your earlier question, that is a way if they want to keep kind of domestic movie going strong, they can kind of lean on Disney to do that and freeze out all the other studios. And in many senses, that seems to be what's happening.
What kind of Hollywood movies typically stand the best shot to get into China and which kind do not?
There is a general feeling that if you're kind of in the more family entertainment realm, if you're a little bit sort of more anodyne as far as political messages go, certainly violence, certainly sexual content, you'll have a better chance. One of the movies we looked at for our piece was Rocket Man, the Elton John biopic that came out in the U.S. a few weeks ago. It's a fairly explicit movie. It has a lot of explicit content. A movie like that, even I think outside the trade war, would have a hard time getting in. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which Sony is releasing this summer, it's Quentin Tarantino's new movie about the Manson family, that's going to have a hard time regardless of the trade war. So while I don't think there's really any kind of sort of hard and fast rule about what movies make it in, there certainly seems to be a kind of bias toward more all-audience, family-friendly films. Certainly if there's a Chinese star or a message that's friendly to the Chinese government, that never hurts, although it's not a guarantee. But they're definitely wary. Regulators are very wary of political messages that might be seen as antithetical to the Chinese government. And so if you want to release a movie there, you better make sure it doesn't have that.
Well, President Trump is slated to meet with the Chinese premier next week at the G20 summit in Japan. We all know that he routinely attacks various Hollywood stars, especially those who criticize him and the industry in general. But any indication if he would intervene on Hollywood's behalf should these trade tensions with China continue?
He's been no fan of Hollywood, at least publicly. We know he's very much been business with Hollywood, had his star made by The Apprentice and NBC. But certainly he's been very critical of various Hollywood stars who've in turn been critical of him. So, you know, it's hard to imagine a world in which Trump really goes to bat for Hollywood in this way. Anything's possible, and certainly protecting American industries has been a hallmark of his presidency. But everyone I talked to for this story has kind of said, you know, on the list of things that Trump is going to sort of argue for, Hollywood is not really at the top of that list. And so it's hard to see that happening in this context.
Stephen Zajcik covers the entertainment business for The Washington Post. Stephen, thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, transforming the sweet, innocent sounds of your childhood into a classic horror film soundtrack. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for John Horn. A beloved toy returns to movie theaters this Friday. Nope, not Woody from Toy Story 4. It's Chucky. A new reboot of the 1988 horror film is campy and creepy, down to its dementedly childlike score. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving demonstrates.
The original Child's Play was like the forbidden fruit. It was a tattered VHS box on the shelf at the rental store that was like haunting my nightmares. There's something so inherently seductive about it when you're a little kid.
Andy, no, please. We're friends to the end, remember?
This is the end, friend.
It was not something I ever thought I would get to play around with.
Bear McCreary is a film and TV composer best known for The Walking Dead and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. He scored two of this summer's big movies, Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and the new Child's Play, directed by Lars Klevberg.
I mean, he has described this movie as E.T. on acid. And I basically pitched him this idea. What if we scored the movie with toys? I wasn't making the toys creepy. I just found the ones that are.
We're in McCreary's studio in Culver City. All around the room are stacks of hurdy-gurdies, accordions, and other quirky, toyish instruments, including a variety of toy pianos.
This one's my favorite.
We sit down on a couch in front of a coffee table where a handful of toy pianos of varying size sit side by side.
The tuning, it is not only in a completely different key, and you can see on the keys it says what notes they are, and it's a lie. Those are not the notes. That is not a C. But the tuning is especially weird. Take a listen to this. If I play it in a different key, you'll hear it even more. These are supposed to be different notes. Once my 5-year-old daughter got wind of what I was doing, she came in and started looking around and tapped the toy pianos. And she realized I stole her toy piano and her brightly colored bells. And she said, I want my piano. It's my piano. Multiple times I had to pick up this toy piano, and it's not one of the smaller ones, take it back into the house, set it in her playroom. She would play it for like a minute and then go do something else. And then when she's not looking, I'd pick it back up and bring it back out here. And yeah, that was really fun. I definitely borrowed a lot of toys from her room. So you have these sounds. That's Chucky's new theme. So these little things, they look like Muppets, but they're called automatones.
It's true. They have Muppety-looking heads, but with a silicone texture and a body shaped like a musical note. Almost like an upside-down Pez dispenser with a giant, manipulable mouth.
And they essentially are like a ribbon controller synthesizer that has a little face, and when you make it talk, it verbalizes a sort of a wah-wah sound. It's ridiculous, isn't it? It's the funniest thing in the world.
He pulls out a different kind of automatone. This one's just a giant Muppet-like head.
The larger automatone has a more digital sound. I am not very good at it. But what I was able to do within these sort of choir textures, I was able to create what sounds to me like a little doll. And I would stack these and I would play them slightly out of tune with each other. And it just sounds like in the middle of this horrific score, like there's a little doll going, Mama, Mama. I'm just going to play you the theme, and the first thing you're going to hear the toy pianos and the auto harps, and then immediately you will hear the vocals. And my voice is featured very prominently in the film. You might think it's a choir of 12-year-old girls, but it's me.
In the movie, the consumer version of the Chucky doll, aka the non-demonic version, is programmed to sing a friendly little tune called the Buddy Song. Bear McCreary knew he would get to write that song, but...
What I did not know when I signed on to the movie was that they were going to cast Mark Hamill as Chucky. And sort of an unexpected surprise was that Mark really can sing.
You are my buddy until the end. More than a buddy, you're my best friend.
And Chucky sings it throughout the movie, and it kind of becomes twisted and sinister as his relationship with Andy changes.
You are my buddy until the end. More than a buddy, you're my best friend.
This creepy little ditty by Bear McCreary is coming to a theater near you. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
And that's it for today. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow. I am your